From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments from the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents part three in a series of discussions about the political and historical foundations of modern conservatism in the life, statesmanship, and writing of Edmund Burke. The panelists are Harvey Mansfield, Joseph Hamburger, Louis Lipsitz, and Paul Kress. Harvey Mansfield recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book about theories of executive power. He teaches government at Harvard University. Joseph Hamburger teaches in the Department of Political Science at Yale University. Louis Lipsitz and Paul Kress teach political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The conversation turns now to the interplay, in Burke's view, among notions of prescription, religion, and politics, and to questions about Burke's rejection of the French Revolution and his endorsement of the American Revolution at the end of the 18th century. Here is Harvey Mansfield.
Well, for Burke, religion was connected to prescription. He was a religious man, one could say, but he was not a devout person. He did not write devotional literature, to put it mildly. He wrote marvelous political speeches and pamphlets, in which, of course, he often expresses the need for religion in society and its beneficial effects. The religion that he wants seems to be the religion that a people has. He doesn't seem to require that the world become Christian. He was, in fact, a great proponent of toleration, both in England and in Ireland. Toleration for Catholics, who still suffered under civil penalties that had been put on them in the preceding century because of the great religious civil war then, and toleration for dissenters, who also were under civil penalties or civil disadvantages of the same kind. And he, in addition, mentioned Jews and pagans, whom he would like to see tolerated in much greater measure than they were in England. But for him, the importance of religion seems to be connected to politics. Religion makes us aware that there is a power greater than ourselves. I think that, for him, is the essence of religion. And, the main reason why he was against democracy is that democracy is shameless. When people get together, they each of them have so little responsibility for the whole that they forget themselves and thereby become shameless. Religion reminds us of shame. It reminds us that there is a power greater than ourselves and that we are subject to duties which we cannot ourselves choose to forget.
So, would you say then that for him religion is politically useful?
It's politically useful, but it won't be politically useful if it is merely said to be politically useful. You know, people also have to believe in it, and I'm sure he believed in religion in some sense. I say he was not a devout man, but all one can say, I think, is, I don't know about his own personal belief, all one can say about his opinion, I think, is that religion and politics have to be inseparable.
Yes, and he did say, did he not, that man is a religious animal?
He did,
indicating, as you say, that it's something that he cannot and ought not get away from.
Yeah, and here we have another, I would say, misconception of Burke's, and another element in his thought, I think, that makes his thought somewhat dated. I don't think Burke could imagine the current secularized, almost thoroughly secularized welfare states of Western Europe where belief in God has drastically declined since the end of the Second World War, the belief in an afterlife. If religion is so essential for a stable political order, if you need a sort of a infusion of religious of reverence to make politics work properly and make people sort of supply the element of conscience, then how can democratic politics or any politics work in a society where where real religious belief and practice has declined so drastically? I think you can't find the answer for that in Burke. You have to find it somewhere else.
Well, there would be an answer in Burke, I think, but it would be a dismal, a deeply pessimistic answer. Arguably, today, our societies in which there is so much agnosticism, which are so secular, are living off the moral and religious capital of past ages, and it may be that the kinds of problems that Burke foresaw for societies that were without religion and therefore without morality, that those problems are yet to appear in those societies that are still decent societies. But I'm wondering if the rest of you would agree with this, that perhaps Burke would have been sympathetic with the famous observation made by Nietzsche at the more than 100 years after Burke about the consequences of the death of God. You remember that Nietzsche said that God is dead now and that in the next centuries terrible things will happen. And who's to say that they have not happened?
Burke saw some of those terrible things in the French Revolution. Indeed. He saw the death of God in the French Revolution, and he remarked on it, not exactly in those words. The liberty that we have won't work unless it's restricted by an understanding of the liberty that we don't have. And the liberty that we don't have is the liberty to violate moral principles and to oppress our fellow citizens.
He assumed that we did not have a choice between a perfect world and an imperfect one, but rather that we had to make our choices within the context of a complex and imperfect world. And there is a passage in the Reflections where he talks about prudence involving the choice of inconveniences, a choice of one evil with a lesser evil, or a partial good and a partial evil. And it seems to me that is an aspect of politics that is always with us.
For him, most choices boil down to necessities. Understanding things politically is seeing what you must do. It isn't drawing up papers which make an outline of the options available. So in this way, I think he's very much opposed to the fundamental optimism of our politics, or of our liberal politics, which is so much based on choice.
Harvey, this leads me to a kind of ironic reflection. So many political philosophers and thinkers about politics have been thinking and philosophizing about Burke. And yet so much of Burke's own work, as you indicate, grows out of his the situation of the statesman, the person immersed in political life, dealing with necessities.
Look at Burke's own career. Look at the many unexpected events that happened to him. And yet, isn't it the case that there's a fundamental consistency in his political attitudes throughout his life? Doesn't this suggest that there is something which ties his career together and leaves it as something more than an accident?
Now, I suppose you're wondering about how we can regard him as having been consistent, in as much as he opposed one revolution and defended another. He opposed the French Revolution and defended the American Revolution.
That's a great division of his life, I think.
How would you make those two, his reactions to those two events, consistent?
It's not easy. People at the time thought that because Burke had supported or at least accepted the American Revolution, that therefore he should be ready to promote the French Revolution. Not only people at the time, but friends of Burke's. People in his own party and friends of liberty around the world wrote to him and said, why is it that from the first you seem to have been opposed to the French Revolution, whereas you were a longtime friend to the American? I think finding the answer to that question is finding the clue to Burke's fundamental politics.
Well, my impression is, just to step back from this for a second, that he wasn't so much a defender of the American Revolution as he was a champion of the grievances of the Americans against the British Crown. And really what he sought was not to, once the revolution was underway was another thing. What he hoped to do was to forestall the revolutionary developments, to develop that kind of compromise, that arrangement between the colonies and the mother country that would make revolution unlikely or unnecessary by the colonists. He recognized, he really saw clearly the handwriting on the wall. Other people did not. And here, this was wise statesmanship, I think, from his point of view. There were real grievances developing in America, and those grievances needed to be dealt with by the mother country. In the French case, I think here again, had the situation been similar, Burke would have advised the French monarchy to make those reforms that were necessary both to preserve itself and create a more stable society. But the French situation was much more volatile and more volatile than anybody realized. And the rapidity of events in France, unlike the United States, made it very difficult for anybody to foresee, I think, just how quickly things would develop.
That seems sensible to me. In the first place, Burke was opposed to the imprudence of the British in their American policy. They were acting like a bunch of lawyers. They were trying to establish rights and not looking at facts. Burke said, I do not know how to draw up an indictment against a whole people. But that's what the British government was trying to do. And it was indicting the Americans for failing to adopt the British legal principle that they had a right to tax us.
Might one say that he was being consistent in this respect, that he was opposed to the theorists of French of Revolution in France, but also opposed to those persons who were using abstract theory in trying to devise a remedy for the conflict between the American colonists and the British government, and so that here is another case where that which he was opposed to in the one case France was on the left, and in the American case it was on the right. But he's consistent in that in each case it was the use of abstract theory that he was opposed to, and he was consistent in that respect. And of course the theory that was being used in the British case was a particular theory about the rights of the mother country, which were greatly divorced from the facts of great distance and from the fact that that theory had not been put into practice for several generations. And it was in this connection that Burke coined the interesting phrase salutary neglect. He said that the British had adopted a policy of salutary neglect, that in other words, that they had allowed the American colonists a large measure of self-government for a long time, and then suddenly, radically, in the 1760s and 70s, suddenly they wanted to apply a particular theory of government which defined a right of taxation. Which of course, as a result of that policy of salutary neglect, was novel to the Americans and appeared revolutionary.
Salutary neglect was recently misquoted by Senator Moynihan as benign neglect.
Indeed.
I wonder if I might interject something here about on behalf of Tom Paine, who was Burke's great opponent and wrote his Rights of Man in response to Burke's reflections on the French Revolution, and who argued that taking a Burkean point of view, simply meant that you were willing to endorse those political arrangements, however they came about, that were inherited from the past and which had, after a time, become acceptable. This then became your heritage, and then you were obliged to defend it. But the people who called for new changes under current circumstances and who sounded a little bit radical to you, of course, this was unacceptable. But were they successful, however, at Berkey in 100 years in the future, of course, would have to say, well, now that's become part of our heritage. The conservative position then becomes a kind of reaction all the time to really the past successes in the various struggles for power, so that
Berkey and principles, I think, are not used to defend successes in the past which were radical successes. That is, one could make Burke consistent, considering now his reactions to the English Revolution of the 17th century, the French Revolution, and the American Revolution. One could make him consistent by observing that in two cases he defended the rebels, the revolutionaries, and in one case he did not, yet on consistent grounds. In two of these cases, the English Revolution of the 17th century and the American Revolution, he could argue, and did, that the revolutionaries were not all that revolutionary. They were not really radicals. In fact, they were being somewhat conservative. That is, that they were trying to defend an established order, a social fabric, a customary order that was being challenged from the right side of politics. Similarly, in the case of the American Revolution, remembering what Burke said about salutary neglect, he regarded the Americans as trying to preserve a kind of practice, a political order that had come into existence, but which was being challenged by the Tory government in England, which was trying to suddenly transform it. Now, in contrast to these two revolutions, in the case of the French Revolution, the attempt at radical transformation came from the revolutionaries themselves. And I think this may explain why he opposed the French Revolution and was much more favorable to the other two, on the consistent grounds that in all cases he was trying to preserve an existing order against a radical regime that held out the threat of oppression.
Well, I think there's another reason too, and that reason gets more to the point I wanted to make about conservatism and Burkeanism, and that is that there were elements in the French Revolution, particularly the egalitarian elements, the tremendous emphasis on popular consent, which I think Burke found objectionable and which conservatives on the whole have been at the very least ambivalent about ever since. And I can easily imagine Burke being able to accept the American Constitution, not the revolution itself maybe, but the Constitution, and seeing it as a good compromise in which there is some element of consent built in, but there was not terribly much emphasis on popular consent. But I can imagine Burke over the last 200 years fighting tooth and nail against every extension of the suffrage and every effort to make government based more clearly and closely on consent, going right up to the Supreme Court decision that declared that one man, one vote was the appropriate way for all elections to be carried out in American political life. And yet at the same time, you might say a contemporary Burkean conservative would have to say, well, the principle of consent and the principle of the Constitution and equality are now part of our heritage in America, and that in the Burkean sense, it would be conservative to defend this as part of our political tradition, but yet fight every step of the way to make sure that those elements actually didn't come into the political tradition. Do you see what I'm saying?
I think so, but I think you...
But you disagree with it.
I think you exaggerate the extent to which the French Revolution involved the idea of consent and equality, and I think it did not, and that was one of the reasons why, with regard to consent, that's one of the reasons why Burke was so opposed to it. He discerned very early, as you yourself were saying, before, he discerned that the revolutionary government would be an oppressive government, and that would which would impose a kind of regime on the people contrary to the consent of the people.
There's another element here connected to what we're discussing, and that's isn't it the attitude of the French Revolution toward history, or the revolutionists, that they would leap into tomorrow, they would seize the day, they would make history now, and the claim, at least, of the British and many American revolutionaries is. And it has been said that they were recapturing something. They were recapturing rights that they were entitled to.
But Burke was not the kind of conservative who fights every step of the way. He was a genuine reformer. For example, he didn't have a policy of salutary neglect toward the slave trade. You know, at the end of his life, he drew up a plan for a reform of it, looking to the abolition of it, and gave it to William Pitt, the prime minister. So I don't think one can simply say that he endorsed the status quo and would contest every departure from it.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to the third part in a series of conversations about Edmund Burke, the 18th century English statesman and political philosopher, and the foundations of modern political conservatism. Subsequent programs will treat Burke's legacy of conservatism viewed from contemporary perspectives. The panelists were Harvey Mansfield, Joseph Hamburger, Louis Lipsitz, and Paul Kress. Harvey Mansfield is a professor of government at Harvard University. As a scholar at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a book about theories of executive power. Joseph Hamburger is a political scientist at Yale University. Louis Lipsitz and Paul Kress teach political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Soundings now turns to comments from another scholar at the National Humanities Center on the topic of professional ethics. Here is Warren Reich with a review of The Verdict, a film about ethics in medicine, the church, and the law. Warren Reich is professor of bioethics at the John F. Kennedy Institute of Ethics at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C.
The Verdict, the film starring Paul Newman and directed by Sidney Lumet, deserves careful attention because of the profound questions it raises about the ethics of the three most powerful professions in our society, medicine, law, and clergy. The drama conveys much more than a story about an exciting court case involving some professionals who violate rules of proper conduct, such as truthfulness, honesty, etc. It has a deeper message, for it raises several fundamental questions about professional ethics. First, where do we find the roots of professional ethics? The roots of professional ethics are not found in the moral rules known from philosophy and religion, but are associated with what it means to be a professional. Although it is difficult to find agreement among professionals, historians, and other scholars on this point, I think it is safe to say that the distinctive character of a profession is not found in the prestige, privileges, or learning of its members, but in the fact that a professional is one who professes or pledges to pursue a way of life in the service of some higher good in the community. The hallmark of our relationships with each of the professions is trust, for in each case, it is our vulnerability that leads us to seek the aid of the professions. Vulnerable with our illnesses or injuries, we approach the medical profession. Vulnerable to penalty or retribution, we ask the help of the legal profession. And vulnerable to disappointment in our hope for transcendence in our personal lives, we approach religious ministers. The Verdict gives us a jarring account of vulnerable individuals who are abused rather than served. The pregnant woman who is inflicted with a permanent vegetative condition through medical negligence. The nurse whose career is permanently destroyed by a powerful, self-protecting physician. The female attorney who is sexually manipulated as a condition of gaining access to an important position. the Catholic attorney who is pressured by an archbishop to abandon a case out of respect for the greater good that institutions can accomplish when they are not embarrassed by public scrutiny of their failures. Through these instances of moral insensitivity, the film jolts us into re-examining what is at the core of professional ethics, dedicated service to vulnerable people in an atmosphere of trust. A second question raised by the film is this: what is the major issue in professional ethics today? The verdict seems to suggest that it is the problem of institutional evil, the institutions being hospitals, dioceses, the informal guilds of lawyers and physicians, etc. One sees this institutional evil when those in control of professional institutions pursue their self-interested task of always winning with such power and self-righteousness that they are no longer able to perceive the truth about themselves and their own profession. The tragedy of this story is to be found not simply in the lives of the people who are destroyed, but rather in the professions themselves. For what this film really reveals is that professionals and corporate groups of professionals are capable of withholding the truth about themselves from themselves, and nothing can be more corrupting than that. The function of the trial was not just to bring justice to an offending physician, but to bring the larger aura of truthfulness to the professional institutions and the public they serve. The film raises a third question: are the professions capable of moral change? One perceives in society a cynicism about ethics in professional and public life, a cynicism that feeds on the assumption that dominant values in our culture cannot be changed. But there exists a long-standing tradition in ethics that immorality represents a curable disease of the spirit rather than some unalterable deformity of will. Intellectually, the verdict falls into the tradition that respects the transformative principle. We can change and should be about the business of changing our own moral dispositions as well as the moral orientation of powerful institutions and professions when we or they produce moral evil. What was most deeply moving about the verdict was that the transformative enterprise was undertaken by such an unlikely individual. Frank Galvin, a failure in his professional and personal life, overpowered even by his own fellow professionals, took on a quite hopeless case in the apparent belief that moral change is possible and that truthfulness is a powerful instrument of moral change. The verdict, by screenwriter David Mamet, who relies on the novel by Barry Reed, offers an intellectual and moral challenge to anyone seriously interested in professional ethics.
Warren Reich is a professor of bioethics at the John F. Kennedy Institute of Ethics at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. As a scholar at the National Humanities Center, he's writing a book about the concept and application of moral autonomy in medical decision-making. You've been listening to Soundings, Conversations and Comments from the National Humanities Center. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. This is Wayne Pond. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.